At Rural First, we're the leader in rural construction loans because we don't work here. We work out here. We live rural, which means we know just what you need to build rural. Our dedicated team of loan specialists works with you throughout the construction process. And with our digital tool, you can manage your project all in one place. That's how Rural First gets you closer to what matters. Rural First is a registered trademark of Farm Credit Mid-America. NMLS 407249. Equal housing lender. Loan subject to approval and eligibility. Other terms and conditions may apply. Visit ruralfirst.com for more details.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Whether you're hunting the back 40 or chasing game deep in the backcountry, the all-new Razor Guide Pack from Outdoor Edge has it all. Coming in at only 12 ounces and in a premium wax canvas roll pack for compact storage and travel, the Razor Guide Pack is 7 blades in total, including a 5-inch replaceable blade folding knife, a 3-inch replaceable blade caping knife, and the flip and zip saw for wood or bone. For more information, visit OutdoorEdge.com.
Welcome back to another episode of the Western Rookie Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Krebs. Dan Matthews is here again this week. He is on the road, coming back from South Carolina with the family. I'm sure there'll be some stories, and we're going to do a little BS session before we get our guest in here for episode 59. So how's it going, Dan?
Man, it's going pretty good. Just been on the road all day, and still have about 4 hours left, but dude, life has been good. Traveling, moved into an apartment, still getting that buck hard horned on my trail camera, and I'm just waiting, man. I just keep hoping every night at like 10:30 he's there, and I'm like, please just shake your antlers off right there on camera for me.
Oh, that would be the dream. That would be sweet to get like a three-part picture of your buck fully antlered, shaking his head, no antlers, to hit your phone.
Yeah, that's kind of my hope. I haven't had any other bucks hard horned until last night. I had one that had a single spike on it, and that was on a different camera. But everybody I've seen, I mean, it seems like people are collecting sheds all over the place. So I wonder why in my neck of the woods they're holding on so long.
Yeah, speaking of sheds, you missed a great episode last week. We had Branson Krebs on, who, if you haven't listened to that episode yet, I just found out is my cousin. So that's pretty cool to have a cousin from Montana that's a full-time outfitter, and he finds a ton of sheds every year.
Dude, the more I can talk to people who find sheds, the better I feel like my odds are going to be. But at the end of the day, I think I'm just a crappy shed hunter.
Well, Branson finds... He said last year he found 200 whitetail sheds and about 50 elk sheds.
Holy cow. Yeah, that would be the dream, man.
Yeah. We talked a little bit off air about like being cousins and trying to get together on a hunt or something. And they just picked up a new lease, 80,000 acres in southeast Montana. And when they were walking it the first, I mean, this is like an outfitter lease, right? Like this is part of their business. They don't really get to hunt it. But when he was hunting it with the landowner and the landowner's sister to kind of like walk around, take a look at the property. But then also I think part of the deal was like, he was supposed to help like guide the landowner's sister on an elk or a deer. And they're just walking by elk shed after elk shed. And they're not saying anything. They're not picking them up. They're not pointing them out. And so Branson's like, what is going on? And he's almost like afraid to ask because this was his first contact with the landowner and he's trying to make a good first impression. And so eventually they split and he's guiding the sister and he's like, so what's kind of the deal? Do you guys usually like walk by all these elk antlers? And she goes, yeah, we don't really pick them up because they're like big and bulky and kind of like hard to carry. They're kind of heavy. We don't really like do anything with them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Dude, I want to get on a property like that, man.
Oh, he said it was phenomenal. Like, we're walking past match sets, big browns. He's like, that's a 350-inch bull, like, just walking by all these sheds. He talked to the landowner again just recently before the podcast, and the landowner mentioned that they have to go work this set this weekend cleaning off their alfalfa center pivots for whitetail sheds, otherwise they'll pop all their tires. And Branson's just thinking, like, hello, pick me, I volunteer.
Yeah, do they need a hand with that? I mean, I'm happy to volunteer my services.
Right, no kidding. So hopefully in the future years, Branson and I'll be able to meet up and do like a shed hunt. He's super busy this spring building a house. I'm super busy this spring, you know, getting done with residency, as me and my wife look towards buying or building a house later this year. So it's not going to work out this year, but hopefully next year and the future years we'll be meeting up for a long lost cousin hunt.
Yeah, man. Well, we've got some big news, you and I, about shed hunting.
Yeah, we do have big news. Just finalized the plans, this last week?
Yeah, we finally set a date to get out with Steven and hopefully find a ton of antlers. I mean, the pictures that he's been sending us in the group text have been mind-boggling. And I'm like, if we find half that many sheds in our trip out there, because I mean a lot of these pictures are single day deals,
yeah,
where like he goes out and they just find a pile, and I'm like, man, if I can find like a couple nice sheds that aren't completely chalky, I mean I'd be happy with chalky ones even, but if I could find a couple brown sheds, oh man, I'd be over the moon.
Yeah, my goals for the trip would be to find a good 6-point brown elk shed and a good 4-point brown mule deer shed. Like, I'm not even talking big, like just a good brown elk and a good brown mule deer. That would make my entire trip.
Oh yeah, just nice and clean. I feel like one of us is gonna find a match set. My fear, what I would hate, I mean, it would still be cool, but I would hate to like find the second antler and somebody else found the first one, and then I have to give my antler up to complete the set.
Or, yeah, we'll have to talk about like shed ethics, because I probably wouldn't care that much to keep it matched unless it was a freak. But
yeah,
like what if you're like walking a line and all of a sudden you see my dog Grizz come flying out of nowhere, drop his head, pick up an elk shed and run back to me. And you're just like, well, I didn't see it, but I would have, like, stupid dog.
No, what I'm going to do, I'm going to bring a super soaker to use as like one of those spray bottles for a dog. So if he gets in front of me, I'm just going to spray him like, no, bad dog.
Right. Yeah. I've always told people when I shed hunt with him in Grizz, I'm like, hey, you're probably going to see it before him. So if you do, just be like, hey, I see one, and then let Grizz find it. And even if he brings it back to me, like, I'll give it back to you, but I just want to keep him on antlers and keep him getting better and better. And so I've always said, like, if Grizz is in front of you, just call the antlers before he finds them. Otherwise, if he just drops his head and picks them up, he's going to count them as his and then bring them right back to me.
Well, that's going to work to my favor, because as soon as I see him get alert, I'm going to be like, oh, I think I see one. And
yeah,
then I'll just wait to see if it actually is one or not.
When he's running and he just stops on a dime and spins around, you're like, oh, I got one over here.
Yep, think I got one.
Yeah. I'm curious to see how he does with elk sheds, because I would assume the visual aspects of a shed are going to be better for him because it's bigger. The scent aspects of the shed are probably going to be stronger. So I'm hoping he does better on elk sheds than he even does on whitetails.
Yeah, the freshness of them, obviously you're hunting fresh sheds there, but they've got to put off a lot more scent when they drop fresh. Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, there's just it's a much larger pedicle, and just the overall shed itself is so much bigger that hopefully he's just on top of it and he's finding them left and right.
He is sight trained and scent trained, and I did work with him a lot with a set of elk sheds I bought when I first got him. I bought a set off eBay just for that reason, but that was a few years ago, so I suppose I could start playing around. I have two little raghorn sheds behind me. I could start playing around and at least get them back on track for like scent and sight on a small one, and just make sure he like doesn't run past a big brown elk shed, hopefully.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, the thing is, unless we see it, we're not going to know.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm sure there's going to be those that slip through the cracks, but knowing Steven and knowing how good he is at what he does and the spots that he has, I feel like we're going to get into them. And, I mean, when we talked, he said there was very few times that they've gone out and got skunked.
Yeah, he talked like, yeah, we've got – like, we've gone out and not found any before, and then I'm like, oh, no, like, what if, like, that just our luck that happens to us? And he's like, but, like, only on, like, one walk or, like, one day, like, never on a whole trip. And I'm like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, no kidding. Hopefully it's not, like, the freak, oh, this is the first back-to-back days that I've ever had. But what all are you bringing out in terms of, like, gear while we are actually shed hunting? Not necessarily, like, camp gear, but, like, for optics. Are you bringing a spotter, just binos? What are you thinking for that?
I will definitely not go west without my spotter. That's just the point I am in life. I don't necessarily say I'm going to carry it every day or bring it out of the truck, but I'm just not going west anymore without my spotter. I will carry my binos every day, but that brings up a good topic because I'm split 50-50 down the Leopold Vortex line. And so if Vortex is listening to this and they want to help make that better, I've been leaning more towards Vortex lately. But the two pieces of optics I would both be bringing are Leopold 1024s and a Leopold spotter.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, I'll be bringing all my Vortex gear out. Similar to you, like, depending on Steven's recommendation, if we get into a spot where he's like, you know, we're not going to be glassing super long distances, then I'll probably leave that back. But if he's saying like, hey, we're going to be in open country, we're going to get up on a hill, glass a little bit, see if we can pick some out, you better believe I'm bringing that spotter. Because that, like, glassing for sheds is, glassing in general has turned into one of my favorite hobbies. But glassing for sheds when I'm out hunting, I have fallen in love with it, because typically if they're on the opposing hillside that's facing you, you can pick them out plain as day.
Yeah. I'd really like to see what Steven says. Cause if we get to a spot where it's like, hey, we're going to park here, run this finger ridge down, and then like, we'll jump off and start shed hunting. Like, I would be okay with running that finger ridge down, bringing the spotter, setting it up, glassing the whole area before we take off. And then if worst case, I just leave my spotter there and mark it for the day, and then on our way out, just pick the spotter back up. Or if we hunt a spot and then we got like a couple hours of light left, and we go like just basically glass tomorrow's spot in the last hours of light as that like setting sun is just drilling the slope, that's really might make them shine. So it'd be interesting to see what Steven's like strategy is. I'm obviously just going to do whatever he says, like a little golden retriever.
Yeah, no, I think that's smart. You know, going off of his recommendation, obviously this guy's got more experience picking up sheds in that kind of terrain than you and I have combined times five, you know. But I'm just pumped to get out there. And it's funny because I told my brother that we were going to be going out to Colorado to shed hunt. And he's like, oh, dude, you should totally come up here. He's in Steamboat Springs now. And he said they were driving around just looking for animals the other day.
Oh, yeah.
They came across about 700 antelope. He said they saw 28 bulls all together still holding.
Wow.
And I can't remember. I think he said about 250 mule deer they saw. He's like, so if you want, you guys should totally swing up here and check up here for sheds too, because, you know, I found out where all the animals are. And I'm like, well, it's a matter of getting the permission as well. You know, it's one thing to see the animals, but to get permission on the property that they're on when they drop, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of elk sheds, I see our guest is here today, Ryan Carter. Ryan is also a huge elk shed hunter and finds some monster sheds every year. So let's get him in from the lobby and let's fire this episode off. What do you say?
Sounds good.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Hey, folks, welcome back. We got Ryan Carter in the booth right now. As we said earlier, Dan is on the way back from South Carolina with his family. So if you hear any road noise, that's just to be expected. He's going to hop on and off mute as we go. But Ryan, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing good, man.
Doing good.
Beautiful Sunday. It's March.
It's March. Shed season is rapidly approaching. In terms of shed season, Utah just finally joined the rest of the Western states with a shed closure. How's that treating you guys out there?
It's probably needed this year. We have record depths of snow. Some of our ski resorts are reporting 600 inches. There are dead deer and elk everywhere. In fact, right here behind my house, there was a herd of about 21 does that kind of cruised into a canyon 3 weeks ago. They've never come out. I'm sure they're dead. So, as a sportsman, it's our job to kind of watch out for wildlife. And if there's a chance that we're going to push them, I think it's a good thing we're kind of laying low.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And you see a lot of commentary on the Utah shed closure, and a lot of people obviously are emotional about it. And they're saying, you know, why should we not be able to do what we want, but everyone else can do what they want? Snowmobilers, bird watchers. And to me, it's like, well, yeah, but like snowmobilers might cruise through a valley, but they're not trying to like go right where the elk are bedding.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's already harassment laws in place. Like, I hate when we do mandates like masks. It makes me mad.
Yeah.
But as a sportsman and as a guy who just loves wildlife, I'm okay with just waiting. I know it doesn't work. I know people are going to go anyway. But a shed isn't as important to me as seeing Bull X make it through to next spring. So, but like, it's okay.
Yeah, and talking about Bull X. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah. If you can look past the current season or the current position that you're in, whether it's shed hunting or actually chasing after big game animals, to the bigger picture. You know, if you can prevent a population or a group of animals from being pushed out of a feeding area as it's coming close to the end of winter, it makes sense. And those sheds are still going to be there. Somebody else might come and pick them up. But if nobody's supposed to be out there, hopefully they're still in that same spot when you come back to look for them later on.
Agreed.
Heck yeah.
The odds aren't high. You know, the big thing about right now, everyone's excited about all the water, right? Everyone keeps using this word moisture, and I hate it. But there's a ton of water coming down. We have a ton of snow and everyone's excited. Like, this year's just going to be awesome. You know, one thing people need to take into account is body fat. Like, elk and deer don't do well on antler growth the following years if their body fat isn't high. So yeah, we're getting a lot of water and I'm sure the animals that make it are going to bounce back, but we've got to be able to do our best to let these animals kind of just creep through the last, like, 3 months of hard, because in all reality, until about May 31st, these animals are going to struggle.
Yeah. And you've definitely got a unique viewpoint on these animals, because while some guys like to just go out and find some antlers, you're tracking these specific bulls for a long time. I mean, I've been following you for ever since I had my North Dakota elk tag. And even then, it's like, hey, this is MJ. He's got the yearly update. Here's Chunky Monkey. We're back on him this year. I mean, you're following some of these bulls from the time they start really showing some character at, you know, 4, 5, 6, all the way up until the end of their lives. Sometimes it's 12 years. You're following this bull for 6 years in a row. So you really get that viewpoint of what this animal's life is like, not just this shed season and two antlers.
Right. Yeah, that's what I enjoy. That antlers are fun to find, but I like scheming. That's the word I like. I like following these animals and trying to figure out their routines and their patterns. It's hunting. It's not the kill that I really love. So, I like all of it, and I like all bulls, whether they're 6 or 14. But there's some bulls that I really, they set a hook on me, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And then being able to track those year after year. I mean, you're doing a lot of trail cameras. I thought I had a lot of trail cameras back home on our whitetail farm. And then I started hearing you talk about trail cameras and then picturing, you know, it's not a whitetail farmer. You're driving a ranger around to every tree and you don't even have to get out to check them. You're going miles in with a backpack full of batteries. That's a whole different landscape of putting trail cameras out.
Yeah, we do some work. That's for sure.
You're playing like the computer version of chess online where it knows all of the moves. And me and Brian are over here playing checkers on a board that we crafted out of materials that we found at our house.
Yeah,
it's all the game, man. Some versions are harder. That's all.
I do have to jump in. I forgot to hit the record button, so I'm gonna hit that right now and we'll capture some of this video, because there's definitely I want people to be able to see Ryan's backdrop, because Ryan has a bull that he calls Chunky Monkey. He's followed this bull for a long time, and it is probably one of the best backdrops we've ever had on the podcast. This thing is a toad.
Oh, I don't think there's a question. That is definitely the best. I mean, Brian, don't get me wrong. I love your shed rack behind you. It's phenomenal. But, dude, that bull, I'd trade a lot of those sheds for just an opportunity at that bull.
I would, too.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something about big elk, and that's originally what drew me to your page and following your story, Ryan, is – I got that once-in-a-lifetime North Dakota elk tag that had some really good bulls in that unit. And then from the second I started Googling, like, big elk, how to locate a big bull, how to stay on a big bull, I mean, it was like your name was every other source. Like, every other podcast was, like, tracking big bulls with Ryan Carter, whether it was a Gritty episode or someone else's, and then all these, like, Instagram hashtags kept pointing back to your page. And so that's when I really started understanding, like, you're taking this big bull, this big elk game to a whole new level.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I screw up just like everybody else. But I do like trying. Like, I love trying. I'm cool with it.
I think the difference is, you might learn things that didn't work along the way, but you don't stop. You get back on that bull. I remember one story. I don't know. It's you hunt with a Kyle a lot, and I don't know if it was Kyle or not, but I think you guys were after MJ, and something happened. It didn't quite work. He came in, but he was too far away, and I remember the podcast. You really just told him, like, hey, he's going to be back in 12 days. You can keep hunting, but I don't expect we're going to see him for like 10 or 12 more days. And sure enough, like day 19 of the hunt, he came back on his pattern and he got him. And so I think that's the difference, is a lot of people would be like, oh, it didn't work, let's go chase this other bull.
Yeah. Well, Kyle's a different breed. And this is that, I mean, this is a credit to Kyle more than it is me. What he did is he walked in on him in the dark on his way to his tree stand. And I mean, he kind of got up. He wasn't like super scared. In fact, he didn't run real fast. He was so wide. That bull, oh, if I remember right, he's 57 on his inside. Like, he's stupid wide. When he walked away, he just kind of tipped through the trees and kind of did his thing. But I still told Kyle, I said, odds of him coming back between our next 10-day window are just bad. Like, go home. And the problem with Kyle is he just won't. Like, he sits on these elk till it's go time. And to his credit and perseverance, that bull finally came back in. He killed him. So,
yeah, to sit a tree stand in the mountains for 10 straight days, I'm sure he's sitting morning to dark, not taking any chances for one animal, and you're going 10 straight days without getting a glimpse of him. Man, that's mental toughness.
Yeah. Yeah, that guy. Last year he came again. And I love having Kyle in camp. Like, his optimism is just, I mean, it's contagious, right? It almost irritates the shit out of me. But last year he sat for a bull we call JJ for 25 days before I made him pull off the bull and go chase some other elk. And that's, I mean, it's a pretty cool story, but it kind of goes to show how dedicated that guy is.
So when you say that Kyle's coming back to camp, I mean, you're hunting a super hard to draw tag in Utah, right? I mean, I looked at the odds and I'm in for it. I just jumped from like 0.2% to 0.4% chance that I'll get to come hunt with you next year. But so you guys are really leveraging like the Utah Game and Fish tag auctions to be able to get your repeat clients back in camp year after year, right?
Yep. And I mean, to Kyle's credit, everyone has this opportunity. They auction off tags. Each unit, they take a percentage and they auction off specific tags for certain areas. He likes to do this Boulder archery hunt. He hunted this bull. He sat on this bull for 18 days before I got mad at him. And then he almost killed another bull called Uno. And he's just awesome. But Kyle, it lives in North Dakota. He's probably up in your neck of the woods somewhere. Does well via the oil industry up there. And that's what his goal is to try and buy this archery tag every year. There's only one. It's not cheap, but it's not terribly expensive considering the class of bull he's chasing. And that's what he wants. Like some people, you know, some people like boats. Some people like ski passes. Kyle Ostrin likes hunting archery elk on the Boulder.
Yeah. I can't blame him. Some people like the chance at a 400 inch bull.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm not the guy that would give up like different hunts just to pursue one big animal. But if it was between fishing, I would give up fishing every year for the rest of my life to every other year get a chance at an animal like that.
Yeah, there's something about those big bulls. And I think Dan and I spoke briefly before the podcast starts, but we're really interested in jumping back to the beginning. Like, what got you into big bulls, tracking them, and like trying to put together the scheme, as you said it, like the pieces, figuring out the puzzle on all these bulls and how to consistently, you know, get opportunities, whether they work out or not. But you're pretty consistently getting on these bulls year after year.
I don't know. What started me, probably just some kind of sickness, I guess. Maybe my grandpa, he told me in my 20s, he said, hey, you can like be good at one thing. You could be good at fishing or you could be good at elk hunting. You can't do both. And he was like, but when you're my age, you should be fishing. So I jumped into elk hunting pretty heavy. I drew a tag in 03, killed a really nice, like 370 something bull. And for 03, Utah still hadn't cracked 400. I figured my best chance at keeping on chasing these giant elk would be to start guiding. So I spent a couple years with a small outfit, went into Christensen Arms, started figuring out these elk on the Boulder unit. And I think once I started figuring patterns out, once I started like getting on top of these elk, like there's a pattern to this one and a pattern to this one, I really think it kind of turned into a sickness for me because it was my goal to figure them out. And I'm a big whitetail hunter. And so I took a lot of the tactics that I had from learning how to hunt whitetails and just kind of shoved them into the elk woods. And I mean, it's different, but it's the same. Wallows are big scrapes. Like there's certain behaviors that kind of carry over. They elk have a lockdown just like whitetails do. They have a pre-rut pattern. Everything kind of follows the same suit if you know how to look at it from the right perspective. So once I started figuring out the pattern, I think the hooks just got set.
And then that's when you started being able to really apply it to get back on these bulls year after year, or you see a bull and you know kind of where he's heading and that we should kind of expect him back in our area when he's done with his loop, right?
Right. Yep.
So is that something that you think your average DIY guy can implement to some degree, assuming, you know, maybe he's going back to the same unit year after year. He might not be able to spend 20 days like you and Kyle put towards a bowl, but he's going back to the same unit at least. So the land is staying the same. Is that something that he can kind of start to piece together year after year, season after season, or is it something that you really need to be there for the whole season, kind of be a local to really put the whole puzzle together?
It all depends on kind of what tag you have. And by that, I mean, like, you can't pattern rutting bulls. You can't. There is a pattern. They have a routine. And that pattern can be done, I don't know, July and August. That pattern can be done January to February 20th. They have certain routines during certain times of year. But once the snow starts climbing, just like in shed season, the elk you've been watching since January, they go from 6,000 feet to 8,500 really fast. Same thing happens like once they start peeling their velvet. And typically elk start shedding their velvet August 20th, 18th. But they'll stay in there and they rub, they kind of go nocturnal, a lot of them, and they sit and scrape all their velvet off. And they'll stick around till about Labor Day. But once Labor Day hits, they're gone. So to say, like, I want to chase, like, pattern a bull and kill him, that only works if your season dates fit in that window. Does that make sense?
Oh, for sure.
So to go back to your question, it depends on the tag you have. Because if I had a rifle tag early season here in Utah, I don't care how many cameras you run, it doesn't give you a whole lot of intel other than figuring out what age class is, which is the goal of the camera in the first place, right?
Yeah.
But if I had a rifle tag and I knew I was going into this unit, I would pay more attention to where elk rut the years prior. That's why guides have the upper hand on a lot of these DIY guys that have waited 15 years for a tag, is because the guides are there every year. They know right where these bulls go to rut. It's a huge upper hand. The rut is a totally different game. But preseason, early season archery tags, you can pattern stuff.
Yeah. That's a really good thing to keep in mind just for people listening, and they're like, oh, this is, you know, Ryan just runs his whole same whitetail playbook on these elk and it's going to work for me on September 18th in Montana. Well, probably not.
Probably not.
But I would be like, I'd probably be your least favorite client, because I've heard you talk about like what you do. You really love that August timeframe, being able to put the pieces together, put a plan in motion, and basically ambush, right? I mean, you know the pattern, you get the tree stand, we're going to be in there early before he comes through. And then I've heard you say over and over again, like once Labor Day hits, everything goes out the window and our only tactic is to rip bugles, right? We're going to start bugling bulls in and we have no idea what's going to come in. It might be the bull you're looking for, or it might be 30 bulls before we get to the one you're looking for. But when you say stuff like that, I get super excited, like, man, to have 30 bulls on like a good day to interact with, that's the kind of elk hunt I would want. And I would just sit there and soak it all in and then basically just shoot the last bull that comes in with the time we have left.
Dude, I'm with you. That's not a bad way to go, because like that's why we're elk hunters, right? Like the rut is the romance, the rut is the drug. There's nothing wrong with that. I just, like, when you wait 20 years for a tag, I tell guys, like, we want to do everything possible to optimize age class. And it's not even score. I try to tell them, like, hey, we're going for the older bulls. Even if my biggest bull that year is 365, that's what we're going to go for. We have to optimize and do what we can with the best we got. And I like age.
Yeah, I think age before beauty is becoming the new norm across pretty much every hunting aspect. Even the whitetail crowd is starting to look more towards age than just antler size, right? Because you get fooled a couple times. You get a two-year-old or a three-year-old that just looks like a giant thinking he's five or six, and you shoot him and you realize, that didn't really work. We can't just go off the antlers. If you really want to manage the health of the herd, you really have to figure out how to age an elk, which I gotta imagine that's kind of difficult unless you're doing it every day. Like, what's the difference between like a 5-year-old bull, an 8-year-old bull, and an 11-year-old bull? I don't think a guy like me could tell the difference, except for if you took the antlers out of the equation, right? You block those off and say, how old is this bull? I would be shooting in the dark.
You want my perspective on that?
Yeah. How do you go about telling, like, this bull is this age?
You can't really see it after a certain age. 5 and 8, there's a really big difference. 5 years old, their legs look really long. They're not. They're the same length. It's just their torsos seem to get bigger. That little ring, if you can see on that bull behind my head, this little part of their neck, kind of behind their ears, you'll see the head kind of necks down and then the neck bulges out.
Yeah.
Older age class bulls get these huge necks, just like a white-tailed deer, and you'll see it just as they're feeding, as they're moving, like they have these big old fat noggins on them. Their nose actually looks like it shortens up. It doesn't. It's just
thick,
kind of bottlenecking out.
Yeah,
you can see it, but not a lot of guys can see it. And then depending on where you're at, it's hard to tell as well. Like, some elk just don't have the same genetics. Like, I hunting that giant bull in Arizona a couple years ago, like, let's see, 2020, we killed that 468. I kept watching that bull, and the bull next to him looked 2 years older, and he was only 390. And then there's this bull, the one we killed, that was 460 something. I could see 200 pounds on the other bull. I could see the fat nose. I could see the bulge on the neck, the big belly. He had everything else to say, I'm that much bigger. But he still kind of moved out of the way for this younger bull just because his headgear was so big. I mean, and I probably would too.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I like how you say he was only 390. Like, if we're talking about any other elk in the world, it'd be like, dude, that bull is huge. He's 390.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What did anyone, I suppose you spent so much time looking at both bulls as a part of that experience. Do you know if anyone got that other bull?
As of last fall, he was still walking. Yeah.
Okay. It'd be really cool to eventually, like, to close the story out on that bull too, and then age him so you could look back and see how close you were. Like, was that bull really 2 years older or not? How big, how old was the, they call it the freak bull, right? The 468. Yeah. Did they get,
he was only 8 years old. Yeah.
That's wild. Cause that, my bull in North Dakota was 8.5. And I will be completely honest. When he stepped out, I was not looking at how old he was. I was like, yep, that's a bull I would be happy to tag. And sure enough, I brought him home.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I sent you a video of a big bull, and that was kind of the first time I reached out. And I reached out thinking, like, this guy's super busy. It's getting close to hunting season. There's no way he's going to be able to, like, see this on Instagram and respond to me. And I get a voice memo from you instantly. And I was like, holy crap, he actually responded. And I remember that bull looked fat. I remember looking at that bull looking like he came out of a feedlot compared to the raghorns we usually chase in general units across the West.
Right. Dude, that's what we do. We kill the nicest when we get close to, right? Like, I always tell guys to focus on the wow factor. Like, once we get into the rut, do we really need to scrutinize 15 inches? I mean, let's start looking at, like, does he make your eyes pop? Is he what you wanted out of this whole thing? If he's not, let's keep going. There's more elk. There's always more elk. But sometimes it just feels right, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if we were out and we had a bull that's just charging into us, I mean, he's big, he's mature. There's no question about if he's old enough, but he just comes in charging, stomps right up in, seeing red. He comes into like 10 yards from the shooter. I mean, that's the kind of experience where that alone is worth a bunch of inches, right? I mean, to have, you know, right, like fist-to-fist contact with a big bull, that's worth more than, you know, like you said, that 15 extra inches.
I agree, 100%.
How often does that kind of happen and play out when you're in the units you guys are hunting? Is it pretty common you can pull those bulls right into someone's lap?
Well, that's the difference between over-the-counter tags and limited entry tags. You know, I deal with maybe 40 tag holders on a unit that takes 5 hours to drive around. And yeah, all those 40 guys have 20 guys helping them. I mean, that's what we do, right? Like, you get a tag and you want your dad and your brother and everyone there. So yeah, there might be 200-300 guys running around, but it's still a unit that takes 5 hours to drive around. So yeah, there's days like, and in all reality, after day three, typically I don't see another guy through the end of the hunt, except for like maybe on the roads when you're driving back to camp. It just seems like you're limited entry. There's just a lot of bulls. And you've just got to sit and weed through elk. So it sounds ridiculous. Well, I called in 23 bulls today. It's really like, it's awesome, but that's how it works. And I always kind of bitch. I'm like, man, I hate the rut, but I don't, I love it. I just hate trophy hunting the rut. I have to specify that.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine that with that many people out there hunting, but like you said, limited entry, most of these guys are hunting it smart. They're not going in and blowing out areas. And so even with, you know, like you said, 200-300 people running around, the actual felt pressure by the animals is probably nothing in comparison to an over-the-counter unit.
Oh, but yeah, easy. I mean, it's, and you know, it's everyone's perception's a little bit different, because there's places that you can hunt elk that you can glass every elk you hear, right? Like, or give it a couple hours, he'll eventually kind of move out to where you can see him. Where I'm spending most of my time, where this guy lived, I don't even carry binoculars ever. Like, if I see a big bull, I typically know who he is. Like, I don't need to like sit and count inches and see what I have going on. So there's a lot of different in each perspective of each unit, but yeah, I mean, I know it sounds so stupid, but calling in 20 bulls in a day, like on a limited entry unit, that's an easy thing. You don't have to be some, you know, professional caller. You don't have to be Rocky Jacobson, like little PVC pipe. You do it. It's pretty fun.
Man, that sounds like I need to just move to Utah to speed up a couple years off of the process of getting that tag and trying to experience that. Or like you said, I think on other podcasts, it's like, just buy a spike tag and come out here and bugle in a bunch of big bulls for a week and then hopefully find a spike at the end and bring some meat home.
That's something to experience. I'm telling you, like, the opportunity's there. It's not like what I'm doing is something that is only reserved to some guy that makes a ton of money in the oil industry, right? Like, yeah, it's nice having a tag in hand, but in all reality, to experience what I experience is, any guy can do it. If I can do it, any guy can do it.
That's crazy. Yeah, I mean, and it's not uncommon for outdoorsmen, hunters, to have that once-in-a-lifetime hunt that they do. You know, like, most people don't go shoot a big Yukon moose every year of their life, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the one thing they save up, they chip away at it, and eventually they go. I mean, that could be the very similar thing to, like, the Boulder unit in Utah, to have that experience, to be able to chase a 400-inch elk, and to have, regardless, have an amazing week, you know, hearing bugles and chasing down bulls and having all kinds of cool encounters. Like, that could be a guy's once-in-a-lifetime thing. Like, he's going to elk hunt the rest of his life, but he's going to do it one time where you hunt in like a magical unit.
Right.
And yeah, that seems like the beauty of the whole thing with hunting the West is that you can be building points in multiple states. And in some of those states that you're building points, you could still be going and hunting over the counter every year. And then, like you were just saying, Brian, once or twice or a handful of times in your life get to go and experience a hunt where you are calling in 20 bulls.
Well, and if I can offer any, like, any advice to guys that are building points in these states, you know, we always say once in a lifetime, but I can't tell you how many wives bitch at me about once in a lifetime hunts, because every guy has 10 of them. It ends up working out that way. And man, if I can give advice to people, I'm like, you know, we got our big three. Like, I know there's 400 inch bulls in multiple states, but in all reality, your big three is Arizona, Utah, and Nevada. They are your once in a lifetime elk units, and they're some of the hardest ones to draw. If you ever get it, that's probably your only chance. Whereas New Mexico, you could probably draw every 5 years, depending on how aggressive you're being on the like good units. Wyoming every 10, you know, there's places you can go every couple of years, like go kill some elk, man. Don't sit and wait your time for these big three states. Go to Idaho every year, like go kill some elk. It's that's how you learn. You're just going to fail and fail and fail and fail and then score, but you're not going to come to Utah with your 20 years of waiting and kill something decent unless you've got a few bulls under your belt.
Or a heck of an outfitter team.
Right.
Or one heck of an outfitter team. Yeah, I can't imagine how much stress and anxiety I would have if I drew the boulder tag but hadn't gone elk hunting in 20 years. Like, I don't know if my gear is good enough. I don't know if my body's good enough. I don't know if I'm going to make the good shot. But you take that and you flip it and you say, I've elk hunted every year for the last 20 years. I've shot 6 bulls with a rifle. I've shot 5 bulls with my bow. I know what's going to happen. I know how I'm going to react when that bull comes in. I know my gear's dialed in. And then you go do that tag. I mean, you're going to have the bull you shoot may not change, right? You might have an outfitter team that can get you the same animal, but your experience along the way is going to be drastically different.
Mm. So goes anything, yeah. Right? You know, you're going to the NBA playoffs. You've wanted to play ball a few times before, so you're more
prepared. Yeah, I feel.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
I feel like there's that mindset now. I see it a lot more, at least with whitetail hunters, where they'll go out early season and shoot does, and they're like, I just want to get that, like those jitters out. I don't want buck fever when the buck comes in. I want to know from my stand, are deer spotting me? Are they winding me? What's like just getting the practice and the repetition of it and being able to perform under pressure on something like a doe or something like an over-the-counter elk unit is only going to elevate your game once you do get this tag or a tag in a much better area.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And even like, dude, just letting the air out of something makes you just feel better. So I love that thought. You know, I can't stress that enough how important it is. And even like trying to mentor young hunters, I'm like, man, take your kids to Texas. Go shoot some stuff. Let them have the experience of just letting the air out of a few things. It's going to make them feel more confident when they're here doing something that took them 10 years to get a tag or 15 years to get a tag. They have some experience. They're not nervous with a knife. They know how to open something up. Those small things are a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a buddy that we're going to try to get on the podcast, and he did his sheep slam with a bow. It took him 7 hunts to get them all. He did every one of them on the first hunt, except the stone. No. Yeah. The stone took him 4. He hunted 49 straight days before his first shot opportunity. Wow. Across 4 hunts. And he says he goes down to Arizona, New Mexico, because he loves elk hunting, but also to like get him ready for what it's going to be like to send a $40,000 arrow on a sheep. You know, like get that blood pumping. He says every time he goes to the range, he fires his first arrow at 100 yards cold. I mean, because there's no way you can possibly replicate it. That's better than shooting at 20 and then 40 and 60. He's, you know, right out of the bat, we're shooting 100. And so, but he says the exact same thing you did, which is let the air out of some things. Stock mm-hmm. as many animals as you can.
Mm-hmm. Well, then that guy, there's a lot of wisdom in that. I'm the same way with my bow. I always, like 70 yards is my kind of punchline. I like 70. And I don't know why that is, but that's what I do when I get out of the truck cold. 70 shows you every flaw. Like 20 yards doesn't tell you anything. As far as from a hunting perspective, right?
Yeah.
Once you're dialed at 70, 20, 30, 40, it's no big deal. And unless something's wrong with your bow, which you got to go paper check it, you know. But for the most part, once you have that dialed, you can consistently hit those numbers. I've never shot a $40,000 arrow, so that guy's perspective holds a lot of weight, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of wisdom in what he's saying.
Well, I mean, most of your clients probably are having that same perspective, though. If they're going to buy the tag, depending on which tag they buy, if they're buying the all season, was it, you have one, they do like an archery or rifle, and then one that's like an all season, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So those guys probably know exactly what that feeling is like, aside from not wanting to miss the animal, but just everything it took to get to that point as well.
Right.
You know, like you said, the once in a lifetime hunt, you told your wife you were going on for the last four trips, and you know, all the pressure of being away from home and the buying the tag and getting the outfitter, and finally it's all here and I got one chance to not mess it up. And then you start thinking about that, and that's probably what leads to more people messing up their shot than anything, is just worrying about messing up their shot.
Panic. Very, very valid panic.
How often do you see like a client starting to panic when they got a giant bull in front of them? Do you like, Kyle sounds like he's just a stone cold killer, so maybe not him, but someone that's kind of new, like they drew the tag and then they reached out to you and said, hey, I drew the tag, can we hunt together? Do you ever see people like start to panic, like they just start losing it when there's a giant bull coming in?
Yeah, man, these 20 year tags, that just comes with the turf. That is part of the whole thing. I see it a lot more in rifle guys who try to come do archery than anything else. Like, rifle guys tend to lose their stuff after day five. Like, they're not like what we do. And I was just like, dude, it's only day five. Like, relax. Tomorrow's a better day. But, you know, it seems like the archery guys I get in are typically a lot better, a little more composed, and they understand their success rate's only 30%. So, you know, seeing somebody panic, that just happens. And in the moment, the nice thing about like rutting bulls is you screw up one shot, it's a matter of getting the wind right, getting to the next draw, getting in front of them, go again. You know, that's when you want to be in shape, because you can get that four times in a day sometimes. But before the rut, ambush hunting from a tree, you panic, you miss that shot, that might have been a $40,000 arrow for sure.
That's wild. That's another level of pressure that I have yet to experience. But like I said, I'm building those Utah points. Utah is my Hail Mary state. I haven't started Nevada yet. That's probably something I should look at. Arizona, I'm actually treating more like a 10-year state, because I think the hunting is so good down there. I don't know if I want to wait to draw the best tag or just draw a good tag and hunt it maybe three times in my life instead of one time.
I like where your head's at.
Yeah.
Yep.
I got a whole roster. And I've been telling Dan about this, and I've been showing him like these charts I make and these spreadsheets that I track my points and track seasons. And you know, I got the Colorado and Idaho are the every year option. Colorado's the fallback option. Idaho's the plan, the people that plan out their life a little better, because you got to buy that one in December. Montana and Wyoming general are good like 3-year options. They're getting worse, right? It's starting to be a 4-year option. And then you throw in the rest, right? You can throw in New Mexico as a wild card state. You never really know when you're going to draw, but like you said, depending on how aggressive you want to be, you could draw that every 3 years, pretty easy. It might not be the best, but then you get the special ones. Colorado, the northwest corner of Colorado, Utah, Nevada, those are the Hail Mary states in my book, and that's kind of how I lay it out. You know, I'm going to try to hunt elk every year in either Wyoming, Montana, or Colorado, and I'm going to build points across the rest. Every 5-10 years, I'm going to cash in on Arizona. Whenever the great state of Utah pulls my number, I'm going to cash in Utah, and we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, I like where your head's at.
After seeing Brian's spreadsheet, I am officially hiring him as my hunting broker.
There's people that have made full-time businesses out of that exact thing. It's getting a little bit less common now that it is getting easier to apply to Western states. Not that it's easy by any means, but you used to have to like mail in your applications and look through the book to see what unit you wanted to apply to. Now you can usually Google everything you need to do and do it in about 15 minutes.
Well, and everyone's perception is different. Like, everyone has a different end goal. If you listen to, you know, like Corey Jacobson, like they did a podcast talking about the states to apply for and the states to ignore. And Utah was the worst state out of all of them to even try for. The demand's too high. The number of permits is too low. Never apply for Utah. So keep your money, put it over here. But to their perspective, I don't know that 400 inch bulls are on the roster. They just want to kill elk, and there's nothing wrong with that. So to validate both of you, really, like, making Utah your wild card state is pretty smart, because let's build points. Let's go for it. I think tides are going to change here. Utah this winter, they lowered the age class across the state. I think you might see a trend kind of that varies a little bit like Arizona and Colorado. I think the Boulder, the Beaver, San Juan, you're going to see turn into unit 2 and 10 in Colorado, to where even the guys with the max points going in with 34 points and still have less than 1% draw odds, I think it's going to be there, because they're going to push all these guys that are 20 plus in for premium units because they want the best bull possible versus just cashing in and shooting a nice bull. And so some of these units are going to get harder. And then, but like all of Arizona, where we have a lot of options for like late archery, you're going to see a lot of guys able to hunt elk multiple times in their life. They might draw the late archery boulder tag 6 times in their life, because it's only going to take 5 points. And a lot of people are mad about the whole point system changing or the age class dropping. I haven't been too concerned about it, because in my opinion, I mean, I see just like right now, I have 7 bulls that are over 11 years old. I have 2 that are 14. I don't know that anybody's even shot at these elk. Like, they are hard to hunt and hard to kill. And I think I'm going to have 2 or 3 of those forever on that unit. I think it's possible. Whereas a lot of these units, I mean, there's going to be places in Utah that you're just hunting to find the best bull you can, or possibly a 6 point. There's going to be a few of those units.
Okay. That brings up a really interesting question to me. So the whitetail world, almost everyone pretty much understands it, where your 2-year-old buck's hitting about 50%, 60% of his max. 3 is like 80, 4 is like 90, 5 is 95, and then they go to like 6 years old is 99%. So they're basically saying diminishing returns at 5 years old. And that's why the whole whitetail world puts like the bar at 5, right? Some people are extreme and they push it to 6 or 7, but pretty much 4 or 5 years old. What's that age for an elk where you're so close to the true potential that animal has that it's maybe not worth letting him go another year? Like, you might get a little bit of inches. You also risk having a bad winter. He could get hurt. He could get shot by someone else. Where would you draw that bar as someone that really understands these big bulls and has seen it back across their lifetime, so that we're not, you know, this bull gets 14 and he just goes off and dies? You know what I mean?
It's really hard to say, because genetics play a huge role in that. Utah kind of has like this latitude, that kind of run these units in a row that run east to west, right? Beaver, Dutton, Boulder, San Juan. They're all kind of on the same parallel, and they just have these freak genetics. A 6-year-old bull might make book. Whereas up on the north half of the state, it might be 9-10 years old before that bull even sees his potential. But even on the good gene areas, I typically don't see bulls kind of really branch out till they're 8 or 9 years old. So it'd be nice if we kept a couple units that the age class was kept high, 6 years old plus. I don't know if they're kind of taking that into consideration. I have no idea what they're looking at, but I don't know. MJ, you know, we talked about MJ earlier that Kyle killed. That bull was 14. And at 14 years old, that was his best year. I watched him go from 330 to 360 to 390 to 370. And I mean, year after year after year after year. And for whatever reason, in 2017 at 14 years old, I mean, intact, that bull went 423. I don't know why. It, just a light winter, went in with lots of fat, didn't rut too hard. I don't know what the like key was to all of that, but it's hard to say. I mean, we all want to kill that six-year-old whitetail. I would think your key on elk is at least eight.
Yeah, that's a good perspective to put it. Basically double it for the whitetail, 8 to 10. And then I suppose after that, it's like you said, it all depends on the situation, the environment. How bad was the winter? How hard did he rut? How bad of a fight did he get in with another bull? Did he get an arrow in his shoulder? Anything can happen for like the next six years, and it can, he can go up or down. I have heard reports of people that follow big animals, especially mule deer is an interesting one, where these bucks will, they'll rut and they'll be, you know, part of the rut, and that people watch them. And then for some reason, the next year they didn't rut at all. And people don't understand why, but I've heard stories of like, yeah, we watched those bucks. They went up high. They never came down for the rut. And the year after that, they put on like 30 inches. Do you see some of that going on where like these bulls get older, maybe they get their butt kicked and they quit rutting as hard, and then they just eat and grow antlers, and that can affect the size the following year?
Yeah, I think that's pretty standard. There's a biologist that used to talk about shirkers and it crossed the board ungulate behavior, where they would just skip the rut and the next year put on 60 inches, whatever it was. I kind of think that's old man shit. The rut kicks in. So say, you know, the elk strip their velvet August 20th. By September 5th, they're starting to call a little bit at nighttime. That's when I start seeing your 323 to 340 bulls starting to push cows around. It's like your freshman year in college, right? They're 5, they might be 6 years old. This is their chance. They start pushing cows. By the time the rut really kicks in and the cows are in heat, those bulls are exhausted. Half the time, they're just kind of skirting outside because they're beat, and a 360 bull's taking over. And typically, when we start dealing with herd bulls, they are that 350 to 370 type bull. Once I start like looking at my older age class, like this guy, after he hit 8 years old, I never saw him with cows again. Eight, he had lots of cows. He pushed them. But it was like he learned, you know, I can just follow the herd around. When I smell the hot cow, I have a big enough presence to go in, take her, pull her, do the thing, let her go. Go back to eating, put on my fat again. I'm lazy, I'm old. It's old man shit. It's like, man, I like sex, but I don't like it that much. I don't want to fight you over it. And I think that's kind of what happens. I don't know that genetically there's something in them that says that this year I'm taking this year off. I don't think that's a thing. I really think it's just a matter of age. Like, I know better.
I wonder if it's like you need a unit like that band in Utah to grow these bulls old so that they start to figure out what being an old bull means. And like they start teaching, like in a weird way, start teaching the younger bulls about it. And when you do these over-the-counter units in Colorado, none of the bulls get that old to figure it out. Like, the genetics you're talking about is like intelligence. Like these bulls get old enough, they get to be smarter, and they can just figure out like, hey, it works so much better if I just sit by myself. I don't get bothered. I'll know. I'll hear the whole valley go off, and I'll know that cow's in heat. And I'm big enough, I just walk right in and just walk right out, like you said. And it just takes a unit to have enough old bulls that they start to figure it out. And that's why you maybe don't see that in like over-the-counter Colorado, general unit Montana.
Well, you see that with other things too, like even with guys. You get yourself around some guys who are well off or successful in business, and your odds go way up of being successful in business. Same thing with training dogs. You know, like if you can get a dog around other dogs that are well trained, whether it's for shed hunting or waterfowl or hound hunting, it just makes sense that dog is going to pick those things up a lot quicker. And so, yeah, I agree. I think it'd be awesome if we could just set a baseline of like setting up certain units to where they've got mature bulls, and then the other bulls can kind of figure it out and maybe not wear themselves out so much chasing after cows, or maybe those hormones are just going to take over anyway and they're going to make really stupid choices.
I think you're both overthinking it. I don't think elk are that smart. In fact, kind of when they get to that point, I notice bulls after like seven through like say, like, cause I only run cameras in the summer now, just due to the new law changes. I have to get them all pulled by August. But one thing that I really keyed in on the last like 3 years, old bulls don't run with any other bulls. It's not like I see a 390 bull and a 370 bull and a 330 bull in a group together. Never. They might still kind of be close. Like this bull had a guy named Front Loader. They used to kind of run around together. As they got older, they followed each other, but they wouldn't hang out. I would get one through and then I'd get one through and the next day, always by themselves. I think they just figure that stuff out. I think they get to where they're just tired and they learn, I'll just follow this herd. I'll still get some. I don't have to do the work. I don't think they need a mentor. Right. I guess that's my point. They're not smart enough to mentor each other into working. What I do notice though is cows, the matriarchs will kind of, the group will learn. And I see rut behavior change when matriarchs get killed. So their migration routes will all come down to one cow. They're kind of being pushed down into a certain area, or they know where to go to rut. It's typically the cow that's guiding them, not the bull that's herding them. I think the herd word gets overused because the matriarch's the one that kind of makes those decisions. I will see behavior change with matriarch cows.
That's funny. Yeah, I remember in North Dakota when I shot my bull, it was the lead cow that was directing it, and she also had some really, I would call it like bitchy cow calls, that eventually got that bull to stop raking and start following. And that pulled him right through the window I needed it to. So I saw that and I was like, that cow definitely looked like she was like yelling back, like, come on, Roger, God damn it. Like we're leaving, quit raking that tree. And so I could definitely see what you're saying there. And I think it's kind of funny how it's, you know, it's almost like we need a fourth caliber of bull. Like we got Raghorn Satellite, herd bull. And then we got this like super satellite or senior satellite where they, you know, once they get past the herd bull, then they turn into almost a satellite again, and they just, but they do it a little, they're a lot more successful as a satellite.
Yeah. I think you're just spot on.
I'm curious, what does the behavior look like day to day on what Brian's calling like a senior satellite bull? Are they coming in and breeding one cow and then kind of backing out and taking a back seat again, coming back in a few days later? Or what does that behavior look like? Are you just seeing them way less than everything else?
No, I, you know, it again, it comes down to kind of dates and actual like heat and the moon and all the other rut predetermined factors, if that makes sense. Like, I still think they might go in and hook two or three cows out in a day. And they might even grab those three cows and go lock them down and come back. I mean, to answer your question simply, it would be eating. Like, I think more than a herd bull will do, a herd bull won't even sit and eat, because the second he does and one cow gets up, he's back on his feet, pushing her back into the group. Big bulls still eat. Like, you'll notice they are fat as can be come September, October 1st. They're still fat. Whereas your 330 bulls, your 350 bulls, you'll see their hips starting to pop out because they haven't eaten in 3 weeks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. With that then, I mean, late season or the late portion of the rut, are you seeing an increased activity from those senior satellite bulls because the other bulls are so worn down?
No. Maybe. It's hard to say. It's not like I live with them. But so typically, late season, the elk have migrated quite a ways. I have bulls that'll pull almost 40 miles between August 20th and September 20th or October 5th. They move a long, long ways. And so to kind of monitor what their behavior might be, I can't really say, but I don't think they get more active ever. I think it all depends on the wind and if the cows are in heat and if they're not. I mean, if it comes August 4th, October 4th, and they've all cycled and they're waiting for a second cycle, those bulls might wander off. They may not see another cow till next spring, you know, but sometimes I think they'll stick around and wait for a second cycle.
So these bulls are more like middle-aged men. They're just kind of like, yeah, you know what? I had my fun days. I'm just going to hang back, drink a beer. If the ladies want what I got, you know, I'm here for them. If not, oh well.
It's old man shit.
They're taking your grandpa's advice and they're gone fishing.
Right.
How on a given year, on an average year, obviously things go up, things go down, but how many bulls do you have on your radar? Like, these are bulls we're chasing this year. Here's a band that's going to be good in a couple years. Here's a few that I'm really interested in seeing what happens 3-4 years from now. But how many bulls are, like, on your radar? They're big enough or old enough or unique enough that, you know, maybe they've earned a name.
Typically I walk in each year with about 10. Like, this year's 11. I have 11 bulls. I had 14 last year. Three of them got killed. 11 bulls that I've got to check in and see where they're at. But there's probably, I mean, just talking with it with one of my guides last night, I think I have four that I'm like, these four, they're going to hit book this year. We haven't named them. We're not, we'll figure it out when we see them this year if they're worth our time. But about 10. My worst years, like, we had some drought years, like in 18, 19, that were pretty tough, that I came through with maybe 6 bulls. But there's always just a small roster of bulls. Like, I got to keep tabs on these bulls enough to know whether they're dead, because these guys purchasing the tags, nobody wants to drop 50 grand on a tag that might have a 350 bull. I like to show them, geez, we got 6 bulls that'll break book. Book's our goal. That's the whole goal, is 375. That's what we want. It's just like whitetails, right? Except it's 175. Your goal is to try to find an outfitter that will run book. And then you're like, okay, this guy's worth the 6 grand or whatever it is. Same thing with elk, but we're talking 375, less opportunity. Instead of 6 grand, we're talking 60 grand.
Yeah, that's a big jump up. And so I've heard you talk about it, and maybe it was a few years ago, where you said, like, man, all these bulls I've had in my roster, they're all gone. Every one of them. They either got shot, they got killed, they disappeared. Is it kind of hard to close the chapter on a bull in his story and you know, look forward to next year when you know, like, your favorites are gone? They're not going to be on trail camera next summer?
Right. I think it was the year he died. I think he died in 19, rolling into 20. If you heard me say that, it was probably in 2020. Uno didn't show up. He was one of my favorite bulls for 9 years running. I don't even know how old he was. Like, even our first year chasing him, we called him 38 special. He was a 380 type bull. And that was like, he just came out of left field. I don't know where he was. He could have been 8 then, you know, and he might've just died of old age. My last picture of him would have been 2020, August 28th, still full velvet and just skinny as could be. His hips were popped out. And he was at 11,000 feet, which wasn't his normal turf. He didn't typically walk up that high. And so I don't know if he just decided he was going to work his way up that spring and find a good place and die. But he's gone. Nobody killed him that I know of. But 2020, I was frustrated because Chunky was dead. Uno was dead. Like, some of my top 3 of all time bulls gone. But at the same time, I still had bulls that – on the come up, you know, we killed a bull called Hansel that year. That the year prior was 390. I think we killed him in the 370s, but huge back end, giant bull, made the cover of 3 magazines. He was cool. Like, there's always something.
Yeah. And do you, when you follow these bulls, the bulls that make it on the roster, whether they're ready or not, I mean, I'm sure there's some bulls you're looking at and you're like, I really like what I'm seeing as a 6-year-old, I really want to find him and keep him in the roster until he's 8, 9, 10, 11. Do you really try to find these specific bull sheds each spring? Because I know you're a big shed hunter. Or are you just looking for antlers? Like, I just want to get out and find some antlers.
I just do for antlers. Okay. Like, shed season for me is just – in fact, I don't even go down in that country. I used to. You've heard of Tines Up. When Tines Up got rolling, they kind of took over some of my old spots. I completely backed off some of that country. Most of the shed hunting I do is a little here closer to home. I can keep tabs on those bulls better. It's a four-hour drive down to the Boulder. And so I have a lot of local bulls I try to watch here. And I'm okay. Like, dude, as far as sheds go, I find something brown, I'm happy. I don't need to find a 390 set. It's just exercise.
Yeah, Dan and I are working on a trip to southwestern Colorado, northern Arizona, northern New Mexico with a guy that shed hunts a lot down there this April. So we're really excited. Just before the show, we were talking like, man, if we just find a brown elk shed, because we're Flatlanders, right? I mean, we live in Flatlander Central USA. So if we find a brown elk shed and a brown mule deer shed, we're both going to be just tickled pink.
Sheds are sheds. I mean, it's funny. People do like podcasts and talk about shed hunting. I remember Brian called me and wanted to do a show. And then he's like, hey, I just want to talk shed hunting. That's all I want to talk. Like, give people secrets. I'm like, dude, there's no secrets. Like, I don't want to be known as the shed hunting guy because you don't have to get the wind right. There's no secrets. There's no... I mean, you scout just like you do hunting. If I can give anyone advice on shed hunting, it's you got to scout. Get out, watch them, see where they're at in February, see what's alive. Look for your age class. Like, there's still secrets, but it's not like,
yeah,
dude, you're just walking. It's just exercise. If you take for more than that, you're going to come home miserable every time because the odds of success are really low.
Ryan, I'm curious. You were talking a little bit ago, and I just want to jump back to it for a second, knowing now that there's no secrets to shed hunting, and I can go out there and find a bunch of big sheds. I'm curious, between, you know, 6 and 14 big bulls that you're after each year, how many square miles is that you've got access to or that you're tracking these? I mean, are these all relatively close in the state? Or is this spread out over hundreds and hundreds of miles that you're picking up these bulls?
Hundreds. There's a lot of miles. I have a really good team. I wish I could. There was a time when it was just me and one other guy, like my guy Aaron. We did things just me and him for 10 years. Anymore, I have 6 guys that help me, and most of them are better hunters than I am. That, like, I have a phenomenal team. I can't say enough good things about them. If I could sit and brag, I mean, I think the last 5-day early season, we knocked out, I think we averaged 389.
Oh my God.
And those guys, the smallest bull they killed was 388. It was only because he was busted. I mean, these guys were knocking out some of the biggest bulls in the state, and we followed the rules. Last year, Utah had a rule change. Like, one, you had to pull all your cameras. 2, it was a one guide, one spotter rule. A lot of the outfitters still ran 20 guides, and they just said, oh, well, we're not paying them. And that's their loophole. I made my guys, I said, one, you're not putting any cameras out. We're pulling every single one, which we did. And 2, one guide, one spotter. That's all you're doing. Stay on it. And they all succeeded. They killed some of the biggest bulls in the state following every single rule. I'm proud of them about it. Like, I'm telling you, I got a good team.
So I got 2 questions. We're coming up on an hour, and I want to respect your time. But, man, we're talking giant elk. So it's hard for me to close it. So I got a couple questions. What's it look like when, say, I draw the tag? I make it through the 0.4% chance net, and I get my tag, and I reach out to you, and I say, hey, Ryan, let's do it. I don't care what it takes on my end. I'll figure it out. Do you then say, awesome, like, here's my roster. Do any of these bulls excite you? Like, which one's your favorite? And I say, hey, man, I really like this bull. If I'm doing archery, then do you say, okay, this bull's living here. You're going to go with this guy and this spotter. You're heading here. Dan gets drawn. He likes a different bull, so he's going clear across the unit to a different spot with a different guide. Or is it mostly like, I just want to come hunt elk, and they're all great. Like, I would take any of them. I don't care. Let wherever you think is the best place. What's the breakdown of what people ask for when they come hunt with you?
Everything's perspective and expectation. And that's, I start, every guy that calls me, I have a conversation with. What's your expectation? And I listen to their expectation and kind of try to get a feel of what their perspective is. A lot of times I'll refer them to another outfitter. I want to hunt with guys that make guides look good. And by that, I mean, I want guys who are going to work. I want guys who've killed a few bulls. I really struggle with these guys that have waited 20 years to come hunt elk that don't kill elk. They're hard. Those are the guys that ball up and cry on day five. I have a hard time with the guys that like to name drop, that tell me who they've hunted with and who sponsors them. And I have a hard time with those guys. Not all of them, but some of them. And so I like to listen to perspective and expectation before I ever even talk numbers. Price is one thing, and price can be adjusted. Like, man, you're going to take some weight off my shoulders. Like, price can be evaluated, because I want guys who just want to hunt. I want my clients to make my guides look awesome. And I know that sounds like so stupid, and it's not the way that most guys do it, but in all reality, those are the guys that's why we're so successful. Is I like to pick and choose. These guys are going to do a great job. They're going to work hard. They're family oriented. Yeah, they're trying to bring four of their brothers, but that's okay. We'll put them over here because hunting is family. So, and even when it's not family, it is family. Well, a lot of times I still have lunch with clients that I guided 15 years ago.
Yeah. I like the way you put that. Because my brother's been in the same boat. He bought an elk. He was going to buy an elk hunt for my dad for Christmas, guided elk hunt. And so he was talking, I'm pretty sure it was Jake Clark in Wyoming, probably a generation or two above, older than you, back in like the early 2000s. And he was, you know, going by then. And my brother, like halfway through the phone call, he's like, "It sounds like you're interviewing me." And Jake goes, "Of course I am. Like, I'm at the point where I'm picking and choosing who I bring. I mean, we're going 20 miles in on meals, and you're going to live with my guys for 9 days. I'm definitely interviewing you."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, that's just, that's what we do. Like, we learn, we have a few rough guys, and we're like, okay, I'm not going through that again. Because there's a lot of hunters that just, they're hard. They do not know what they're getting into. They have no idea what it's going to take. And they're always the guys with the highest expectations. They're always the guys going, "This is 24 years. I'm not shooting anything under 410. Dude, there's not a 410 walking in the state of Utah as of this moment right now, not one. So your expectations are too high. Here's the phone numbers to three other guys. See what you can find.
Yeah, you might want to trade your tag for a landowner tag in Texas, because that's where the 410s live right now.
Right.
So I heard you say briefly, I'm pretty sure it was on with Brian Call, that there was a bull a few years back in Colorado that you were looking really hard at trying to find a way to hunt. And I'm just curious, mm-hmm. what bull that was.
Well, that was a bull we called Rudy, and we never killed him. I got to chase him for 2 years.
Okay.
But he lived on a national park. He kind of swung in and out into a couple pieces of private property. The pieces I could get on were the closest ones, and he just knew the fence lines good enough that he outplayed me over and over and over and over again. Hats off to that bull, because he had Ryan Carter's number.
So there was a giant bull in RMNP he was known for massive thirds. He was on the cover of everything. I mean, every out Western photographer in the world took pictures of this bull. Is that the same bull and you just named him something else? Or do you know which bull I'm talking about?
Bull. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Completely different park. Yeah.
Cause when I heard you say that,
well, closer to my turf here in Utah, not over on the park.
Yeah. Okay, because when I heard you say that, was the same time that this bull was on the cover of every Instagram page in the world. It was the year he had those giant thirds. He was like a clean seven. And then you're also talking mysteriously about this bull that's really famous. He lives on a park. I think we might be able to get him, though. And I was just curious if that was the same bull, because that was – I'm sure both bulls were a monster, but that one was a monster as well.
No, he never had that kind of fame. That the bull I was hunting had fame in certain circles. That like a lot of people knew about that bull, but it wasn't like he was not the bull that you're talking about. That guy was mega famous. In fact, if we had to look back on famous bulls the last like 10, 15 years, it would be that bull and maybe the spider bull. You know, that bull went big, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the Arizona Bull got pretty famous, but I think the difference was that bull, what is his name, Brutus or something, Bruno?
All the guys that named him were photographers, and I heard three or four different names, so.
Yeah, he just passed away of old age, or eventually old age. Something probably killed him, but he was old.
He got bored.
The difference was he stood in front of every family that came through RMNP for like 5 years. That's how he got so famous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how that, I guess that's a good, maybe final question. How often do you get, as an outfitter and a guide, how often do you get to go out and put yourself behind the bow or the rifle, whether it's in Utah or other states across the country? How often do you get a chance to hunt elk hunt yourself without like being a guide, just Ryan Carter, I'm out in the woods trying to punch my own tag?
To be perfectly honest, I have no interest in killing an elk. Another elk is it's not there. I like elk hunting and I like seeing other people succeed. This is one of nine bulls in my house. I don't need to kill another elk. I'm not really fond of elk meat. I'll eat a whitetail or axis steer over an elk any day. So, you know, I'm kind of picking up different habits. Like most of my points in the West right now are all on sheep and deer. So hopefully I start drawing some tags.
Is that a product? Do you think that's a product of being an elk guide all these years that you've been there, you've done it. Now you're on to other things because your job has been elk hunting and getting these elk for clients and friends for so long.
Not at all. I think it's just a matter of, I don't need any validation in the elk world. I don't need the meat. I don't need the opportunity. I would rather show up on a buddy's hunt in New Mexico and shoot a 330 bull with my best friend than have my own tag in Unit 9, Arizona. Even though that'd be fun, it's just not on my priority list.
Okay.
I think personally, I've kind of moved on to some other stuff.
That's cool to hear, though. Like someone that's done it, and it's done it to the level that you've done it, to say, no, to me, elk hunting is all about helping my friends and the people I care about make memories and just watching these animals. Like, that's elk hunting to me. It's not punching tags anymore. That's really cool to hear hear someone say that. That's doing it at a level that you're doing it at.
Well, it's nice of you to say, but in all reality, I just learned I enjoy mentoring as far as that goes better than I do actually hunting. And when I was talking earlier about scheming, it's why I bow hunt. I enjoy the hunt. I am not the type of person that just loves the kill. I'm never high fiving. I hate watching elk die. I know it sounds so gay, but that's just how I am. I love trying to figure these things out, put pieces together. It's why I'm not a big rut hunter. I'd rather do the bow guys. I enjoy scheming.
Yeah.
And so, and that's why I like whitetail hunting. I still like mule deer hunting, but mule deer, and I know a lot of guys don't know, but I've killed some giant deer with clients back in the day. I'm just saying, you find them, you get the wind right, they're dead. There's no scheming. Whitetails are scheming, and there's rut behavior, and there's pulling them in. Same with elk, and I enjoy that stuff. I get it out of axis deer, too. I like it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Any plans to, you know, go build or buy or work on a whitetail farm out in the flatland. I know you travel a lot for whitetail hunting, but do you do any of your own like habitat management and just watching your own herd, or you just want to go and spend a week doing it with different places?
No, because I had a lease in Nebraska that we kind of did for, I don't know, 10, 11 years. And it was cool, but we couldn't get the age class up because there were still rifle guys. We took control of the bow hunting portion of that, but they would come in and slaughter them on rifles. So I never had an opportunity to really go at that. And even then, I don't know that I ever want to do that. I love seeing new spots and meeting new people. And even like, say when I draw Kansas every other year or every 3 years, I like to kind of go hit a new spot because it's Kansas. Like there's all kinds of terrain and all kinds of things you can do. Same with Indiana and Illinois and Iowa, and man, I want to go everywhere. So I don't want to limit myself to one spot until maybe when I'm old and have a bunch of money that I can pick up my own piece and start doing some ag maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you got the same bug that Dan's got. He is a traveler, man. He goes all over the country, and him and his family are checking. He's got he says the same thing. He's on mute right now. I don't know if he's driving, but.
Oh no, I'm just soaking in everything I'm hearing. I want to get to that point in life where I've shot 9 monsters and just help other people get big bulls. But I talk about that on the Nomadic Outdoorsman podcast a lot. As the progression of a hunter, it's like you get to the point where you love it. You still love it. You love the memories that you made doing it, but helping someone else experience that same thing is like the next level. But yeah, I like traveling, man. I like going new places, new experiences. I like to try everything before I form a strong opinion about it. And archery elk is going to be that next thing.
Awesome. Well, we're going on an hour 16, about 15 minutes ago. I was trying to wrap this up, but just talking about elk and hunting and especially big bulls, I get sunk. I go down the rabbit hole and I almost can't stop. So, but we do appreciate you being here, Ryan. I want to give you a chance to make some shout outs where people can follow you on social media. If anyone listening to this happens to draw the Utah tag and they want to go out hunting with you, give them a chance to give you a connect with you, whether that's the website or your page.
I respond to most people through social media. All the handles are the same. It's Ryan DC Outfitters or Ryan DCO. I have a really good crew. I like, if I ever give shout outs, it'd be to those guys. I just love working with my guys. Last year I guided one guy. And this year's probably going to be the same. I ended up spending a lot of time helping my clients and my guides. So I'd show up as the spotter. Hey, where are we going today? Just kind of energize camp and get people moving. And I see myself in the future that like my role is going to be mentoring. And I love that portion of it. And so that's kind of what I'm going to be doing. And that's where you can find me. I haven't been great. I think last year I did a total of like 13 posts or something. I've kind of fallen off the radar, but the stuff I still do put out, I make sure it's something awesome and something to share with the world and kind of make some jaws drop, because we do have a lot of cool stuff going on.
If I only make one request, I would request that you bring back Super Bowl Sunday, because it was so much more entertaining watching your story than the actual football game of all these people sending in big bulls, and you can just scroll through picture after picture, a Colorado Giant, a Utah Giant, a North Dakota Giant. I mean, I remember when you were doing Super Bowl Sunday, that was a great Instagram series.
It makes me feel bad I didn't jump on that. I used to do that, and I'd do a shed contest kind of thing, like, hey, show me your photos, let's see who can do this. And I'd let people vote, and I'd round up a bunch of prizes. And it ended up always being a lot of work on my plate.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Like, it's not like I was getting much out of it, but you're right. I probably need to jump back on those things and just to kind of amp the community up a little more, because – that stuff was always fun.
Yeah. Well, no matter how hard you try not to be the shed guy, I feel like you are the guy that made it cool to hold elk sheds upside down.
Yeah. Well, I'm only 5'10", so it's like you flip them upside down and they look big.
It's a lot easier to hold them too that way.
I agree. I like you flip them up the other way and it's hard.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for being here, Ryan. I appreciate it. Anytime you got anything cool going on and you want to hop back on, you're 24/7. You're a welcome guest to the Western Rookie Podcast. That. So thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, folks.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.